we turn together to consider this very fascinating story. Or we should say the first chapter of this very fascinating story in the book of Samuel. A fortnight ago, in our first study, we spent most of our time setting the context and the background of the whole story of Samuel. And we did this by considering the past. And this is really the only way that you can ever consider the present. You've got to go to the past in order to discover how the present has developed. And this we did in a fair amount of detail, and we don't propose to revise it this evening. And we began to see how the situation in Israel had come to the sorry state described in the very last verse of the book of Judges, that every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And we discovered that this was a national situation. It wasn't one or two pockets of apostasy or anarchy. It was nationwide. It was a national situation of spiritual and moral chaos. It was a condition that had become chronic. It wasn't a temporary sickness. It was an established condition of sickness, spiritually and morally. And we indicated a fortnight ago that this was the kind of situation that has to be explained in two different ways. It is explained, first of all, in terms of the sin and the disobedience of a people who had been greatly favored by God. And even though they had been so greatly favored and constantly blessed by God, they became spiritually careless. And that's a terribly dangerous condition to be in. They began to sit lightly to God. They were so sure, you see, that, well, they were the people. They were the evangelicals. They were the fundamentalists. They were the people of the Word. And had this not been confirmed by the blessing of God so signally upon them and upon their nation? And they became careless. They became complacent. And this is how backsliding begins. Backsliding doesn't usually begin with some terrible sin. In the moral realm, it begins with spiritual complacency and spiritual carelessness. And the situation in Israel can be explained in that way. And secondly, we discovered it was a situation that had also to be explained in terms of the discipline of God and the judgment of God. Two concepts that we don't think a great deal about these days in the evangelical church, but they are biblical concepts. And the truth is that God is not prepared to stand back and watch his people, his redeemed people, whether individuals or families or congregations or nations, doing themselves irreparable harm and dishonoring his law and breaking his covenant. And God dealt with the whole nation in terms of discipline and judgment. And we summarized our setting of the background of the whole story by describing the situation in terms of a nation that had lost its sense of God. Now that's as good a description of Britain in the late 1970s as you could get. A nation that had lost its sense of God. A nation, secondly, that had lost its awareness of destiny. And that's a pretty good description of our own land, isn't it? But it's also a very accurate and a very sad description of far too many individual believers. They've lost all their sense of destiny. of the fact that God has called them to His eternal glory. Do you ever think about your Christian life in these terms? Or are you grounded in the earth? And thirdly, we describe the situation in terms of a nation that had exhausted its spiritual capital. It had lived on the capital that previous generations had built up, and it was now exhausted. And that's a good description of a lot of congregations, evangelical and otherwise. They've been living on capital, and that is essentially a short-term policy. And so it was in Israel. And we are faced at the beginning of the story of Samuel with a situation of a nation that was totally demoralized. Not a very promising picture, not a very promising situation. And that's where the story begins. Well, what kind of story is it? Well, we read part of it tonight. It's the story of a family, yes? Or you said, it's the story of a nation. Yes. It is also the story of God. We could describe what we are studying as a human story set into the context of the working of God. And when you think of it, that's really the only way to make sense of your life. For whatever happens to you, you have to say, now, where is God in this? Whether it's simple things or little things or big things and all-embracing things. Whether you're applying for jobs and not getting them, or offering for houses and not getting them, or applying for jobs and getting it, or offering for houses and getting it. Whatever the situation, whatever the circumstances, the only way to understand your life and all the various developments of it is to say, now, where is God in all this? Because without doubt, God is in it. But on the other hand, we could describe the story of the whole of the book of 1 Samuel as a divine story. That is, it's not really the story of Samuel, it's the story of God. It is a divine story. The story of God's strategy, is that a permissible word? The story of God's careful plans and purposes being worked out where they are always worked out, in the nitty-gritty of human affairs. You see, God doesn't work out His glorious purposes up there in heaven. He works them out down here. Which makes every day, let alone every week and month and year, a very significant page or chapter in the story of God's affairs. And I think we've got to see straight away in this story the fact of God preparing the situation. Oh, you say, preacher, I see the point. Well, I hope you do. God is about to raise up a man to do tremendous things in the nation. But then you see, you can't raise up a man, a real man, without that man being conceived, carried the full length of time, and born, and nurtured, and weaned, and taught. That's the context in which God works. When He sent His Son Jesus Christ into the world, He didn't send Him as a full-grown man. He sent Him as a tiny, virtually invisible embryo. I think we've lost our wonder, our sense of wonder with regard to life, We've come to think of babies being born as, well, it's just another baby being born, and we think it's a mercy that the babies have been born when so many babies are aborted and are not allowed to be born. Not by the decree of God, but by the interference of men. I never fail to have a sense of wonder whenever we bring a child for baptism, as we did this morning, thinking of the possibilities that are signified in that newborn life. You see what I meant when I said earlier that in every situation we've got to say, now where's God in all this? And of course, since children are not born without the man and the woman relationship, we've got to see and discern the same wonderful working and planning and strategy of God in all the developing of human relationships. And of course, this story teaches us, Elkanah and his two wives, that we've got to be very, very careful in all that realm of relationships, because all these are fitted into and incorporated by the developing purposes of God. And right at the beginning of the story of Samuel, what we have to see is God preparing the situation in which he will raise up his appointed deliverer. And the astonishing thing, or one of the astonishing things, is to see God preparing the situation, first of all, by not doing anything, and by allowing the situation in Israel to go down the slippery slope, allowing the situation to get worse and worse. That is, allowing both the church and the nation to go down and down and down, not least in order to bring both the church and the nation to their senses. And you see, if people will not learn from the Word of God, the only other way they can learn is from the providence of God. And the providence of God can sometimes be very stern, as well as very mysterious. But when we talk about God not doing anything and allowing the situation to slide, at the same time, we must never think of any situation as having broken loose from God. That can never be. God is always present. God is always working. But at times, God is very, very difficult to discern. Put it like this, there are times when God is very, very difficult to recognize. Well, put it in the form of a question. How good are you at recognizing God in a situation? How long, when you find yourself in a complicated situation, how long is it before you come to the point where you say, now I believe that God is in this? Sometimes we are very slow. And Israel was very, very slow. And in the whole of the first chapter of Samuel, in some ways, there is really not very much sign of God, except perhaps in the heartbroken prayer of Hannah. And even that heartbroken prayer, earnest and sincere as it was completely misunderstood by God's representative, the priest of Israel, Eli. He thought the woman was drunk. He didn't recognize God. Of course, there was a reason why he didn't recognize God. This old priest of Israel, this man favored with significant leadership in holy things among the people of God, was virtually irrelevant in the whole situation. He was being bypassed he had failed. And in his case, there was no remedy. There was no other chance. Time was gone. His life was wasted. And the fruit of his influence was a situation of chaos among the people of God. Isn't that tragic? Can I give you quickly, as we hurry on, two references from Scripture? I see you want to look them up. All right. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 26. Paul is speaking. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 26. I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air. I'm not indulging in shadow boxing. But I pommel and discipline my body, my whole carnal nature, and subdue it. Why is he being so energetic in his Christian life, spiritually speaking? Lest, after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. The Authorized Version has it, lest, having preached to others, I myself should be cast away. I remember reading one translation, or was it a commentary, I can't remember which made the verse read, lest, after preaching to others, I myself should be laid aside as of no further use. That's the story of Eli. Oh, men and women, especially Christians who are middle-aged, don't you comfort yourself with the thought that in your earlier days you were greatly blessed in the service of the gospel. The evangelical church is full of spiritual has-beens. And some of the spiritual has-beens are hardly out of their 20s. Turn back to the Gospel according to St. Matthew. I think I've got the right reference here. Matthew chapter 21 at verse 43. Jesus is speaking to the leaders of the Jewish people, and he says, therefore I tell you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a nation or a people producing the fruit of it. That's the story of Eli. He was being bypassed. He had virtually no idea at all of what God was doing. And that's a man who was as close as any man could be to the things of the house of God. Oh, how solemn it is. But at the same time, never forget that the work of God's kingdom is in God's hand alone, and he reserves the right to recruit, to raise up men and women to do his will, and he reserves the right to dismiss them as and when he chooses, always on moral and spiritual grounds. The story then that we are studying is the story of God at work. And the first lesson we have to learn is the need to be alive to God and to recognize that God is in the situation. And to look at our own lives, and to look at the lives of the younger folk in here tonight in their teens and 20s, and to look at the little children in the Sunday school and the babies in the creche, and to say concerning all of us, who knows but that thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Now, if the possibility be that God has marked you out for significant service, you see to it that you don't get in God's way. You see to it that you stand ready for God. Now, having said that, and that's all very solemn, but very necessary, I want us now to notice, and to notice very carefully, that the story here in the first chapter of the first book of Samuel, which is the beginning of a 50-year significant movement of the Spirit of God within the nation, the story begins with what I think we could rightly call a Christian marriage that had gone wrong. Elkanah and Hannah were believers. I believe they were sincere and genuine and devoted believers who worshipped God. I believe they were married in the will of God. But somehow, somewhere, the thing went wrong. Here we have two devout people in a day of apostasy. Two devout people, a married couple, aware of God, when practically the whole nation didn't bother with God. They were aware of God, and they went up annually to Shiloh, to the feast, possibly the Feast of Tabernacles. Some commentators are critical of Elkanah and say, according to the law, it was required of the Jews that they should present themselves at three major feasts every year. And they say, well, why did Elkanah only go to the one? Well, I don't know. But in a day of apostasy, to find this man and his wife and family making the journey year after year after year, something quite impressive. There is no doubt at all, according to what we read in verse 5, that Elkanah loved his wife, and his wife loved him. No doubt about that at all. But here is what we would call a Christian married couple who had not kept each other close to God. I always say when I marry folk here in this church, always, that they are charged in the presence of God because they love God and because they love each other, never to let each other settle for anything less than God's best. That's the only way to live in a Christian marriage. But something had gone wrong here. And Elkanah and Hannah had not kept each other close to God. But you know, it wasn't on what you would call a spiritual issue that they fell. It was on a human issue. They had no child. Ah, you say, preacher, that's so. Yes. Herbert Dixon and his wife had no children. Is there any connection between that and the fact that at the age of 85, as he told us he was last night, there is a man who is still an active missionary? Elkanah and Hannah had no child. But then you see, they did not accept God's ways with them. They said, why not? Why should others and not us? And I believe in one or other, or perhaps both, a bitterness crept in, perhaps more with the man than the woman. Oh, you say, preacher, how long were they married? Well, I don't know, but it indicated from the story they were married quite a number of years. But then, they must have known the story of Abraham, and Abraham was married for many, many years, and God had not given him his heart's desire, a son and an heir to carry forward the promise. And Abraham waited and waited and waited, and eventually, as we are told at the end of Genesis chapter 16, Abraham got impatient waiting, and he married Hagar and had children, but they were not the children that God had promised him. And between the end of chapter 16 of Genesis and the beginning of chapter 17, there's a space of 13 years about which there is nothing recorded in the story of Abraham, the man of God. Well, Elkanah, perhaps more him than Hannah, did not accept God's ways with them. Now, I know whether it's this or any other sphere, it's not easy to accept God's denials. I usually say when I'm marrying folk here in Sandyford that marriage is a gift of God's grace, given to some and withheld from others, in God's good and perfect will. But some do not accept the ways of God with them. And Elkanah and his wife, and perhaps Elkanah more than Hannah, was not prepared to wait. Their attitude was, why not? And when there was no answer to the why not, then Elkanah took the situation into his own hands and he married a second wife. Now, I'm interested in the story that no one protested that this man of Israel took a second wife. This was not allowed by the law of God. This is an indication of the spiritual barrenness of that generation. It seemed to be accepted, as I fear this kind of thing can be accepted these days, even in the church. It seemed to be accepted that a man could be a believer and at the same time live contrary to God and still go to the feast of God. Oh, something had gone very, very far wrong. But if you read the story carefully, you will see that Penina, Elkanah's second wife, was not in any sense at all of the same spiritual caliber as Hannah. Oh, I don't want to slander the lady. Penina, no doubt, was attractive. Certainly in terms of being a wife, she was successful in the eyes of Israel because she bore a number of children. But she was a sore affliction to Hannah. And I believe if you read the story carefully, you will come to the conclusion that she was a sore affliction to Elkanah as well, because he knew that he was responsible for this whole situation. And I think this is one reason why he gave Hannah the double portion at the feast. It was almost a man saying, oh, my dearly beloved wife, given to me by God, I've wronged you, I've brought this situation upon you, a situation that is grieving you and piercing you to your very heart, and I can do nothing about it. Oh, my friends, what a lesson it is to learn from Scripture that we have to live with our own decisions. And while there are some decisions that can be rectified fairly quickly, there are others that we have to live with for a lifetime. I found myself in preparing for this sermon wondering why Elkanah married this second woman, this second wife. I found myself wondering what he looked for as he looked around for a second girl to marry. And I felt constrained by God to say to you tonight, what did Elkanah look for, and what do you look for in a partner? Do you look for a pretty face? Well, very nice. Very pleasant to live with. Some pretty faces can be very hard. Is that what you look for? A pretty face? Is that the basis of your consideration of a life's partner? You look for someone who is good fun, who is essentially an entertainer, a life and soul of the party, you know, good for a laugh and all that kind of thing. Well, that kind of thing could be fun for a while. You look for someone who is rich or this or that or the other. Is that young people, is that how you think about your future and what your future might be in the will of God if it is part of his plan that you should be married? Do you think on these essentially human levels? Or do you look for someone of spiritual integrity? Do you look for someone who will be to you all that you need to enable you to become all that God calls you to be? Young people, I ask you to take this from me tonight very seriously. And oh, how I love you. And how I look forward to the days when, in God's good will, you may stand there, I may stand there, to conduct your marriage ceremony. Oh, having tasted of the goodness of God, how I long that he would grant to many of you this blessing that is so rich, a true Christian marriage. But oh, my dear young people, men and women, boys and girls, don't saddle yourself with someone who is going to be a hindrance to your Christian life, even if that person is a Christian. Will they help you? And, of course, will you be a help to the other? Young people, not just in your teens, but in your 20s, could God safely give one of his children to you in Christian marriage? Could you be a helpmeet to them? Would you be a partner in Christ with them? And would you in fact prove that you are heirs together of the grace of life? Oh, my dear people, learn from this man's story and wait upon God. Perhaps more pointedly, what I should say to you now, trying to sum up this sermon, is to direct your thoughts to Hannah, who was God's instrument at the beginning of the whole of this story. And the principle applies, be you man or woman. See to it that you are a spiritually minded person with your life given to God, walking in obedience to God, because it is in this way that you will prove his good and perfect and acceptable will. Now Hannah became a man and became a woman of tremendous spiritual caliber. She was the right person to be the mother of Samuel. Wouldn't you agree? But you know, she became a woman of spiritual caliber by a very costly road. It was by the way of disappointment for years. It was by the way of loneliness for years. It was by the way of hurt for years. And oh, how that second wife irritated the Bible, the RSV says, far too weak a word, irritated. It wasn't just a niggling. It was something more like Paul's thorn. Oh, it was like a stake that this woman stabbed the other woman with. Verbally, in attitudes, in actions. Oh, it was terrible. And so much of what was going on, Hannah just didn't understand. No doubt, like many, many before her and since her, she felt that God was hard, that God was denying her. She couldn't understand why it had to be this way. But you know, it was by that way that Hannah became a praying woman. Oh, how she spoke to God. But when she prayed, she had no idea at all of how far-reaching the answer to her prayer would be. Mind you, none of us do. Sometimes we say, oh Lord, use me in yourself. Oh, that's a dangerous thing to pray. God will believe that you mean it. We say, oh Lord, prepare me. Oh God, make me a real Christian. He'll do it. He'll make you a real Christian. You may not like his methods. You may not understand them. You may rebel against them. But if you ask him, he'll do it. But Hannah had no idea of how far-reaching the answer to her prayer would be. She had no idea how costly it was going to be to give up her son and to hand him over into Eli and to the temple. That is, handing him over to what was a ghastly mission field. She had no idea when she prayed just how misunderstood she would be, even by God's appointed representatives. But you know, she was vindicated because God granted her request. It was almost as if God said, here is a woman I can trust. How often it's a woman in the time of crisis. Here is a woman I can trust. Here is a woman who means business. And when Hannah, in that sense, consecrated her life to God, including the dearest thing that she could ever possess if God granted it, namely her firstborn son, when Hannah said, take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee, God accepted her and blessed her, and God's man, Samuel, was born. And right from the start, Hannah recognized, you see, that the child belonged to God, not to her. And right from the start, Hannah determined she wasn't going to get in the way. Can you imagine how Hannah prayed from the time she knew she was pregnant? What a start Samuel had. Oh, what a blessing it is to have a godly, praying mother. Wonder how many of you here tonight have that. And some of you youngsters here tonight, have you any idea how your mothers, sometimes more than your fathers, pray for you and have prayed for you since before you were born and have given you to God as Hannah gave her child to God. Yes, you can imagine how Hannah prayed. But I want you to note as we draw to a conclusion that it was the soreness of life that brought Hannah so close to God. But I also want you to notice that the blessings of God did not take her away from God. Not always, but often, I say, when I'm conducting the marriage service of two Christians, that for some, the blessings and the fulfillment of God-given marriage spells the end of fruitful spiritual service. And it's true. A young man and a young woman, every time you think of them, your heart is glad because they are, in every sense of the term, servants of God. And God gives them to each other in human love and delight and fulfillment. And oh, how soon afterwards sometimes the light seems to go out. The zeal seems to go. The drive seems to be missing. Oh, they still come to church, yes. But oh, they are not what they once were. Wonder if there are folk like that here tonight. It was not so with Hannah. By faith, she kept her vow. Oh, I read over and over the story, and I found myself looking at the verses from 12 onwards and thinking, oh, what it would have meant to Hannah if only the old priest had understood her sore heart and spoken to her a word of encouragement and comfort, but he didn't. In many, many senses, Hannah was alone. But you know, her story tells us of what God can do with one life. Deeply hurt, granted. What God can do with one life that is truly dedicated to Him. I love this story. Hannah never hit the headlines. For a very few short years she had her son. She cared for him and prayed for him. And even after she handed him over to Eli in the temple, possibly as young as a wee bairn of three. Mothers, can you understand what that meant? I think I can. But still she prayed. And when we go through the rest of the story of Samuel, try to remember a praying mother at home. She prayed and she prayed and she prayed. Oh, mothers, mothers in Israel, are you praying, woman? You know the verse we often quote at the Lord's table. What shall I render unto the Lord for all his benefits towards me? I will take the cup of salvation and call upon the name of the Lord. I will pay my vows now in the presence of the Lord. Well, Hannah did. Mind you, when we come to chapter 2, we'll find she got her reward. Because after Samuel, she had three more sons and two daughters. Oh, what blessing. when she thought that life had passed her by. Oh, Hannah had a light in her eyes and a song in her heart all her days. Oh, don't forget. Don't forget the costly dedication. You see, what Hannah did was this. She gave herself to God. And that's what we must do. To trust Him with our lives. Yes, romance included, and work included, career included, everything included. Give our life to God and trust Him with it. Even with the things that are most precious above all else. Husbands, tonight, give your wives to God. Wives, give your husbands back to God. Parents, give your children to God. Children, give your parents to God. And trust God to make your life in the pattern of His good and perfect will. This is what Hannah did. And I think it's expressed very beautifully in the words, "Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to Thee."